and the moss is thriving. I thought we could talk about karma today a little bit. Karma is a word that we've all heard, and it gets tossed around in various ways, but sometimes we don't take the time to really look at what does that mean, what's it about in Buddha's teaching. Karma in Sanskrit literally means action, or intentional action. Any intentional activity we do with body, speech, or mind. And sometimes we might not even notice that we have an intention, but there almost always is some intention. And the Buddha defined karma, he said basically it is intention. And intention is itself a kind of action. It's a mental activity of mind, but then it manifests outwardly through speech and physical activity of the body. So we virtually always have an intention, and so everything we do is kind of based on an intention, or it is intentional activity. We often don't think that, you know, we're just, you know, talking and I kind of pick up the cup here. I didn't even notice, but the Buddha would say there was actually an intention while I was talking to you. There was this also underlying intention to pick up the cup and have a sip of tea. So there are some actions, activities of body, speech, and mind that are not karmic. They're not karma because they're not intentional. Like our heart beating, we don't have to have any intention for it to do that. It just happens naturally. Or it happens according to conditions, but they're not intentional conditions. Because even when we're asleep, the heart keeps beating, the breath keeps going, you know. Something starts to drip down the back of our throat, we cough. It is not karmic activity because it's a response to conditions, but there's no intention behind it. So sometimes it's hard to tell, you know, like sometimes what we think of a spontaneous action, like picking up the cup, if we look closer, well, there was actually an intention there. I didn't even really notice it, but there was. And sometimes we have Zen stories that are like to demonstrate what's the difference between karmic activity and just like non-karmic, like Buddha activity. There's stories like to demonstrate this is, there's a boy sweeping, and this monk says, well, tell me about this kind of karma where you're, where you're coming from some intention, and it's caught up with delusion, versus just fresh activity that's not based on any intention. And he says, "Hey, you!" to the boy, and the boy turns his head, and that's a demonstration of not even karmic activity. We could argue about that, and maybe there was some intention. But it seems like, hey, we just naturally, it's just a, you know, immediate response without thinking about anything at all. We just do that if our name is called. Again, we could argue because maybe there's a very subtle intention to do that, but that was a demonstration of just a, you know, fresh, uncontrived, unintentional action. And then the boy turns his head, and then the Zen teacher says, what is Buddha? And the boy starts like thinking about it and gets all flustered and runs away because his intentional mind got all like caught up trying to figure that out, and he's like, I don't know, so I better get out of here. So that's like karmic activity functioning. So part of karma too, you know, it's, you don't usually hear this exactly in the sutras, but this is my understanding of it. You hear, it's kind of implied in the Buddha teaching. And my understanding is that when we're talking about intentional activity of karma, that it's done from the point of view of a living being that believes that they are like a kind of independent doer, like an actor that does an action, and that they have a kind of independent free will, you could say, to decide this over this, and that that's actually what makes karma. That belief that is proposed, that we all actually have that belief, whether we think so or not. It's a very subtle thing, you know. When we reach to pick up the cup, there's some sense right now for me of like, yeah, I'm doing that because I'm thirsty, and so I'm going to take a drink to satisfy the thirst of me. There's a sense of a me behind that. And then the effect, every karmic action of body, speech, and mind has an effect. So the we often think that the effect comes back to the person who did the action. That's how we usually think, and that's what creates the realm of karma. So technically, Buddhas who no longer believe that there's somebody, some doer here, and some receiver of the effect, they just see cause and effect happening. They just see conditions giving rise to activities, including intentions. Buddhas, you could say, have intentions, but they see that intentions are just conditioned by other intentions and other factors, and there's no independent self behind the intentions and the actions, and that the results of the actions come back to a new, dependently arising living being. Maybe with the same name as the person who did it, but there's not like some thread of a self that continues through. So my understanding is that karma means it's done intentional activity done by a person or some living being who holds the belief in this, that there's this self that's doing things and a self that's receiving the results of actions. So Buddha, as I would understand it, Buddha still has intentions, but it's no longer karmic activity. There's just cause and effect. So part of the implication of karma here, and again, you don't hear this in the sutras, but for me, an interesting thing to explore is the related issues of free will and kind of versus determinism. You know, these are the kind of like Western philosophical terms, I suppose. And and I bring this up because I think it's an interesting discussion, and it's a little controversial, and people get kind of worked up over it. So that's why I like to bring it up. Because this issue about free will, when from this point of view, and we can explore this, that my understanding of Buddha's teaching about karma and intention is that intention is a kind of mental factor that the mind, in Buddhist psychology, the mind is made up of all these different mental factors, and they're all conditioned phenomena. You know, like there's greed, hate, and delusion, non-greed, non-hate, non-delusion, pride, jealousy, equanimity, kindness, all these different mental factors that are listed in the tradition are all, they're not so much, they're not so much aspects of me, because we see it when we look for the me in the center that has all these things, we can't really find the me. We just find all those mental factors. It's part of the reason that they're taught in so-called Abhidharma. Is when we look for this independent self, all we find are these mental factors and the way that the mind is living in the world. So intention, or cetana in Sanskrit, that's the Buddha defines karma as cetana. So what is this action? It's actually it's defined as intention. And intention is one of these mental factors. And like all the other mental factors, it's just conditioned by other mental factors and other phenomena too, not just mental factors. We can be walking along and a tree starts falling outside, and that's not a karmic thing, right? That's like the tree didn't have an intention to fall, and we don't have the intention to make the tree fall. The tree's falling, but we see it and we say, I better run. So we run out of the way of the tree. That's an intention. And you could say that intention is based on the condition of the tree falling. Our intention to run out of the way is based on that condition, but also other conditions like past intentions. Like, last time I didn't run away and the tree fell on my leg and broke it. So that, like, I learned something from the past intention of not moving when the tree's falling. So that past intention becomes a condition for the present intention to run. If you can follow that. So intentions are based on past intentions, and they're based on other conditions like trees falling and the temperature of the air and all kinds of things. But that's all they are. An intention to run or an intention to pick up a cup is based on conditions, causes or conditions. And that's all. So every time we intend to do something and do it, if we look carefully at where that comes from, all we find is all these past other conditions, or really kind of, we'd say present other conditions that are based on past conditions that give rise to an intention. In other words, that's different from the way we, before examining this, the way we usually think is the intention just comes from basically me. That's what we call like free will. Free will is like, should I pick up the cup now or not? I'm in control here, right? I can decide, and I will. I think I'm going to pick up the cup on the count of three. 1, 2, 3. See, I just proved free will. I can do it. I did it. But if we look carefully, if we examine that whole event, we see the whole thing was just completely conditioned. There wasn't really like the me that thought I could do it. That's kind of an illusion. There was really all these conditions. Like, part of the condition is thinking that there's the me with free will. Kind of, but you could say that the illusion of free will is one of the conditions. But it was, past thoughts that, like, well, if this body and mind with all its muscles and all its thoughts and ideas can do this, it can do it again now. And it can happen according to, and dependent on all these conditions. But when I look up free will in the modern English dictionary, it says something like the belief that I actually brought it with me. Free will in the dictionary is the freedom of humans to make choices that are not determined by prior causes. Interesting.
Yeah.
From a Buddhist point of view, we say everything is dependent on causes and conditions, and there's no exception. And everything, every phenomena. You could say Buddha mind is not a phenomena, so you could say that's unconditioned. But all phenomena are dependent on causes or conditions. So free will would be like the belief that we can do something that's not dependent on causes and conditions. So according to that dictionary definition, that the Buddha's teaching would deny free will, as I understand it. And then the opposite of free will is sometimes called determinism, right? And determinism in the dictionary, this is not like some, this is just Webster's dictionary, right? It's not some philosophy treatise. So they're pretty basic, but determinism is a theory that acts of the will or occurrences in nature or social or psychological phenomena are causally determined by preceding events. So according to Buddha's teaching of dependent co-arising, Buddhism is determinism and it denies free will. Doesn't it sound like that? And I think the reason it's controversial is because people hear that. Most people, when I bring this up, they say, well, yeah, there's everything, there's all these conditions, and then we're given all these conditions, and then how great it is as humans that within all these conditions, we have free will. We can decide to do things. You know, it's almost like this combination of like, yeah, we're not denying conditions, but then within conditions, we have this one little thing here that's kind of outside of conditions that we call free will. And that's why we can decide to practice or not. We can decide to do good things versus bad things. And if we didn't have free will, then how could we even practice? And what would practice even be about? I often hear it said something like that.
With determinism, before I heard that, my understanding was that it was more like it was written beforehand, like a script.
Predeterminism.
Predetermined, yeah. I think that's, I don't know, again, with these philosophical terms, how they might define it, but yeah, I think of it as predetermined would be like the whole thing set up from beginningless time, and it's all playing out. Whereas the Buddhist teaching of what we call dependent co-arising is like everything's arising according to conditions in the present. And it is based on past, but the whole thing, it's not like there's a single trajectory that's all like a destiny that's all like laid out from the beginning. It's because it's just present arising, and it's so complex, like everything's included here. So even a Buddha couldn't see like whether I'm going to pick up the teacup or not, right? Because there's so many things, like you know, an asteroid could fall on the Zendo right as I'm about to pick it up. we can't predict these things exactly, right? We can see certain patterns, and we know we have like we call habit patterns. I always do this when that happens. So it seems like kind of a fixed, that almost seems like a predetermined thing. And I think Buddhism would not say things are like that. Everything's very flexible and open because there's asteroids and things like that. So it's not like we have to always follow our habits. That would make practice impossible. So, but we could say if we don't follow the habit, if we suddenly decide I'm going to just do something, I want to have a fresh new response. That's possible. But if we do that, we look carefully, it's not really that I decided to do that fresh new response. We see the fresh new response arose dependent on conditions because there's no exceptions to this. And it's not even some kind of like mystical, mysterious, metaphysical principle. It's like kind of common sense. I think the Buddha's teaching of dependent co-arising, it's so beautiful because it's so, like, obvious. We often don't see how obvious it is, but it's like, we don't have to, like, posit any imaginary thing. It's more like the opposite. We have to, like, let go of our imaginary belief that there's something other than some mystical, metaphysical thing other than dependent co-arising called me, the independent doer with the free will that's going to pick up the cup.
Mystical me.
It's kind of like it, you know, if you look for that, if there really was an independent self that's like the kind of controller of my life, that's kind of is kind of a mystical, strange, ungrounded idea, even though the Buddha says we all actually believe that we're kind of like, we believe in this mystical, illogical, you know, entity of a self in addition to dependent co-arising. So we might say, well, but wait a second, if then like it seems so, then if we really see there's no free will, it's all everything's determined by conditions, it can seem kind of hopeless, or like, well, then I'm not in control of my life anymore. I like, it's kind of, it sounds depressing, right? And I think from a certain point of view, I think that if you see it from a certain point of view, it sounds very depressing and hopeless. But from another point of view, the very same understanding, seen from a kind of like backside or a different angle, is like completely like freeing and liberating and joyful teaching, because we don't have this burden of like me having to do my life, which is usually, I think, is a big burden we carry. What am I going to do next? And like, I am totally responsible for like figuring out my life, and like, what if I do it wrong? And it's such a heavy weight, right? I think we all feel that sometimes. But if we see that actually we don't really have that burden. Things are going to go the way they're going to go according to conditions. And I think the important part is, this is not like a passive thing. It's not like you would say, well, now I have this idea that I'm not in charge, everything's going to happen, so I'm just going to like sit back and like watch it happen. Like, don't move, just wait for everything to happen. That's just kind of contrived, conditioned, kind of sort of stupid idea. It's more like we still keep doing things. We're conditioned to do things, to not just sit back and watch, right? We're conditioned to step forward and do things. So we don't have to stop doing that. It's more like we're still going to like pick up the cup. We're still going to like, oh, here's this habit. Here it comes again. I really like tea. I'm going to have tea. Maybe I shouldn't have another sip. I'm getting really wired here. But I really like tea. I can see this habit. And like, but now I see that the whole thing is conditioned. And I can stop it or not. And if I stop it, it's just due to the condition of some other desire, the desire to like break the habit, right? So it's more like, I think to have this shift of understanding, it's not like our life necessarily would change at all. It's still, we do things, and still intentions are arising every moment, but we're relieved from the burden of like, what if that was the wrong decision? It's almost like in this realm, there's no wrong decision. It's just, you make a decision in a certain direction and there's really painful consequences, and that they become conditions for the next decision to not go that way or not. But see how it's like a little different? Like that no free will is actually this, instead of a hopeless, depressing thing, it's more like a liberating, you know, letting go of the burden of self understanding.
It also feels like a maturation thing too, like a child or an undeveloped person would not assume in this instance a kind of responsibility for for.
So that's another word that comes into this conversation, is responsibility. That because it's this kind of talk sounds like, well, then nobody's really responsible for anything. Which, you know, from a kind of ultimate perspective, I think that's true, right? There's no self is responsible because there is no self. But in the world of where it appears that like this body and mind that's here right now is very closely connected with the body and mind that, you know, was living yesterday in Santa Cruz. And there's not like actually a continuous self, but this one is closely dependent on yesterday's. So, and we all kind of agree on that because we all see it that way. I don't see like, oh, here's this new person who I don't know who you are. Like, it's, you have nothing to do with the Michael that I last talked to. It's not like that. Like, I think, I know Michael. He's, you know, and we have this relationship based on past conditions. And since we do see things that way, it's like if you kind of hit me now and then, like, tomorrow I say, then I see Michael and it's like, he hit me yesterday. That, like, I'm upset with him today. You know, I think because we think that, and we think that it's the same person who hit me, and we kind of agree that that's how the human mind works, even though on the deepest level it's not really true. It's like the you who hit me yesterday is not the you who's here now. But because we agree on that, I think we can say we have responsibility. So if somebody does a crime yesterday and then the police catch them today, then we say they can go to jail, even though, strictly speaking, they didn't really do the crime. That was somebody else yesterday. But because this is conventional truth, we agree that you know, today's person who's going to jail is closely related to and dependent on yesterday's person who did the crime. And, we, you know, going to jail is a conventional thing, too. So I think there is responsibility, but it's kind of like part of conventional truth. And conventional truth is totally important. That's where we live. But ultimately, maybe we say ultimately, I don't really have a responsibility. Or we say responsibility is just like the ability to respond dependent on conditions. We do have the ability to respond to conditions according to conditions. So even, you know, this thing of like no free will and no responsibility is a little bit like a sort of a dangerous teaching, and maybe it's not too good to bring up if people don't really fully understand the implications and how that's a kind of like an underlying kind of ultimate truth, and we still actually live in the conventional truth also, and just as importantly, then it's dangerous because you can use it as an excuse to then assert your belief in the free will to like do whatever you want that's maybe really harmful and not take the blame. Like that's the danger, right? Is, you know, I hit Michael, but you know, I had to because it was conditions made me do it. I didn't do it. You know, we don't want to talk that way because that's really, because really, if we talk that way, it's making a kind of elaborate intellectual excuse for acting from my point of view of myself. I think that's the thing. It's like, if I do hit Michael or hurt someone, it virtually...
I wish you wouldn't use that example.
I'm getting ready. If I, you know, anything that we do that's harmful, maybe this is a leap, but I would propose anything we do that's actually harmful to others comes from the point of view of this illusory, the belief in the illusory self that actually does have free will. So if I really see that there's no free will and everything's arising according to conditions, then I probably would never hit Michael.
Or that it has effects.
Yeah, and I never want to recurring harm.
Effects. Yeah.
I think harm always comes, harming others comes from the point of view of protecting the self, or kind of, promoting or something, the self that's not, you know, the true self that independent of causes and conditions, which doesn't exist. This might get a little, be getting tricky here. But maybe we just open it up for questions, conversation, if you have any.
Yes. Yes. As you were speaking, it came to mind that maybe you're saying 100,000 lives doesn't mean a long period of time. It could be as one is always changing, and the old me or whatever yesterday is different today, and that could be, it could happen from this morning to this afternoon.
Yeah.
With conditions and stuff, so it's a different person.
Yeah, even from this 1 second ago, you're a different person.
Yes. And I was thinking too, what you're saying, if I recognize the conditions that brought me to where I am now, the positive and negative, mm-hmm. I can maybe start to change conditions.
Yeah.
If I recognize what change responses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you change. Yeah, by recognizing the conditions and what and certain intentions that led to certain effects. So this is the part of the Buddha's teaching about why he taught about karma a lot, is like, just watch. You know, you could say the teaching about karma is just pay attention to intentions and their effects. Just watch the process, kind of like an observer. When that body and mind did hit Michael, like he got upset, and then this body of mine got upset, and like that didn't work so well. And like, so let's, next time I want to hit him, let's not hit him.
Or knock him off completely.
Yeah, that didn't even bother me. Yeah, so exactly, just by watching the effects, watching the intentions and the effects, we evolve towards like more positive actions. Our karma becomes more and more wholesome just by watching. So, and that whole process can happen without some independent self that's doing the watch. The watching, you could say, is just another dependent awareness. Consciousness, the Buddha says, is also dependently arising every moment. It's not our self. Consciousness is not our self either. So there's a consciousness, that's awareness, that's watching the process of intentions and hitting and picking up cups and watching the effects, and then that we evolve in a more and more happy direction. And so you could say part of the attention to intention is that intentions become more and more wholesome. The Buddha did talk about there's good and not so good intentions that basically lead to happiness or unhappiness. So that, conventionally speaking, there is that. And the more we pay attention, the more they naturally evolve in the positive direction. But not so much that I'm evolving, more like the conditioned responses are evolving. The shape of the dependently arising body and mind experience over here is evolving. And you could say, and then eventually, it can evolve more and more also towards seeing that there is nobody behind, nobody like pulling the strings, you know, behind the curtain, who's the self that's doing it all. Well, that understanding evolves also. And I think the more that understanding evolves, the more positive the actions become also. So the whole thing goes together very nicely. Yes.
Thank you for your wonderful teaching. Karma is not something I think about very often, so it's good to let it bubble up. And a few things come up around karma. Like, it's such an intrinsic part of our practice. You know, we walk on a kind of a karmic plane.
Yeah, every moment.
As we go forward, mm-hmm. you know, in the practice.
It what?
You kind of eat it up as we go forward in the practice somehow.
How, what do you mean by that?
We absorb it.
Mm.
And we process it.
Or with the effects, maybe we absorb. We're doing karmic intentional activities all the time, and the effects are coming back to us all the time also.
Yes.
That's kind of like the absorbing.
Or the noticing.
And the noticing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the intentional aspect of it, you know, impresses me, that's part of our practice too.
Yeah.
Is awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And we're aware of stuff that we're not supposed to be doing,
mm-hmm.
and stuff that we are doing, and you know, it's kind of a knife edge, the mm-hmm. karma practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a knife edge. Like so much of our life and so much of our practice,
mm-hmm.
the samsara and nirvana, same thing, gasha. And here we are with the karma, and how do we deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
So we deal with it. We deal with it.
Yeah, yeah, and the way we deal with it is karmic, and condition. The way we deal with it is conditioned. And you could say even the awareness. You could say, well, let's just be aware of how conditionality and karma is working here. And but we could say whether or not we're aware of it is also just determined by conditions. So so you could say. I think one of the radical implications is like, you know, well, then let's really practice. Let's really practice being aware. Well, either we will or we won't practice. And that's determined by conditions. And that's where I think, to me, as a practitioner, it's almost kind of scary because it's kind of like, well, I should be practicing harder or something, or more diligently or something. Well, no, I shouldn't. Right, like we're all practicing as completely or as well or as not well as we must according to conditions. So if we think I should be doing better, it's impossible, right? According to conditions, it can't be better or worse. And so again, that's a great relief from the burden of like, well, I really should be doing better. It's like it's kind of an illusion, a delusion. It can't be doing better. But the thought, if somebody says, like, you should do better, you know, then that thought, then that hearing that becomes a condition for, like, oh, they said I should do better, so I'm going to try to do better.
So the aspiration itself becomes a new condition.
Uh-huh, yeah. And you could say, well, why did that, maybe that person has free will if they said you should do better, or if the Buddha comes and says, like, you know, there's no free will or something. You could say, well, where did that come from? Well, that was just conditioned too, and you could say, so we're in a way to come to meditation or to come to a Dharma talk is changing our whole conditioning, right? That's part of the amazing thing is like somehow we find ourselves in a sangha, and that becomes this huge conditioning factor, right? In this wonderful way, I think. It's hard to know whether it's good or not, but it's what's happening.
Could you bring this back to chetana, to
intention?
Intention, yeah. How does this kind of...
Sangha, you mean?
Huh?
Sangha?
Just the actual the intention of this, how what you just said feeds back to the actual...
So whether we practice
have
or not.
We have an intention, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have an intention, or we have an aspiration.
Aspiration, which is a lot like intention, arises, or like bodhicitta, we could even say, you know, the aspiration for complete awakening. You say all this arises due to conditions. And it's usually even taught that way. It's like we can't, even though they say, practice generating bodhicitta now, well... You can't really do that yourself, right? Even like Dogen says, how does this wish to be completely free of all illusions for the benefit of all beings, how does that arise? He says, you can't create it, and Buddha can't create it. Buddha can't give it to you. Buddha can't like zap you, and you can't do it. But it arises, and Dogen says, in the kind of... sometimes it's translated as kind of a mystical communion of Buddhas and sentient beings. Kano Doko. It's like this, basically you could say the dependent co-arising of Buddhas and us gives rise to intentions to practice or aspirations.
Yeah, contact.
And it's so it's again, it's the same, I think the same teaching of it's a dependent thing.
Bringing intentions into this is really useful. And, you know, though we can't see ourselves, or we can see ourselves and we have our DNA that we had for a long time,
DNA arose according to conditions.
But the thing I feel that I bring forward the most is a sack of intentions. And that sack of intentions leads me to keep, I have to show up, you know, for this that I intend to do and that I intend to do. And that it just keeps, you can put words like responsibility into it, but there's also a momentum.
Yeah.
And so you just keep getting in more and more trouble with each of those intentions that keep rolling along. So it's, but it seems like a lot of times those intentions are important to cultivate too, so that, you know, you're putting your intention into going to school, you're going to putting your intention into showing up for work every day, you're putting your intention into your children and their well-being, and it's something that just day after day after day keeps the karmic wheel going.
Yeah, so we do say cultivate good intentions, and the Buddha would say this, give these practice instructions, and then if we look deeper we say, but I can't really decide to cultivate good intentions, right? It's like, but me hearing the Buddha say that, like, I love the Buddha. The Buddha said cultivate good intentions, so now the Buddha saying that is like now a condition for the arising of good intentions, more good intentions. But you could still say the whole thing. I just notice how when we talk about it, we keep slipping back into like, but I can do it now. You know, we keep thinking there's this self that can cultivate better practice or better intentions or give rise to the vow, and just keep, we do. Vows arise, intentions, aspirations, bodhicitta arises, and just, I think it's a great thing to just keep noticing how, where did that come from? Did I do it? Or was it conditioned on, that's why I say Sangha is so great, because when you're around Dharma, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you hear Dharma teachings and it like changes your perspective, and you could say, but I didn't do it. We take the credit, right? We're like, I'm going to practice Zazen every day. And like, I feel my intention so strong. And I feel so strong that I'm doing it. And it's hard, but I'm doing it. And we look behind that and go, where did that come from? Well, we got inspired by something, you know, some Dharma or Buddha or something, or Sangha. So those are like the conditions. And now we have like this, like an umpan ringing. It's like this condition for lunch. It's kind of like, or actually I guess lunch was a condition for the cooks to ring the umpan, and the umpan ringing is a condition for me to say, well, let's try to wrap it up. But one more question.
I haven't been practicing very, very long, but in conditions, in some situations where they say find a comfortable place, and you know this and that. Like I noticed today, it was chilly in there to me, and so that condition leaves my mind until I realize what it's all about. That it's just chilly, and then I can start to live with that.
Yeah. Oh.
But it's a lot of different things, and I know. Anytime I do something, a new condition comes along, it really throws me way off, no matter if it's good or you know, if it's whatever it is, I go tumbling until I get used to it.
The whole thing, it's so dynamic, and it's basically like out of control. I mean, you could say this whole thing we're talking about is that everything is out of control. Nobody's controlling anything. There's just conditions. So, when it starts to seem like practice is just this crazy, haphazard thing. But sometimes it looks like it's going smoothly, but then, but if we step back and just the awareness of that whole process, we see, that's just how it's all going. And I think the thing about, you feel chilly and then you have a different, then maybe we're sitting zazen and it's like the whole zazen period we're thinking it's so cold in here, why isn't it warm? And then you get to watch that. And then you could say another way of talking about conditions and practice is that the more and more you see that everything is just going according to conditions, the more and more you just like surrender to conditions and without trying to control things too much. And then it's just like, okay, it's chilly and like I'm sitting in the cold, now I'm sitting in the hot. And it's kind of like, it's all, we're just in accord with the conditions. Because often we think that there's me that's kind of like being pummeled around and by conditions, and it's more like we're never really, or maybe we should say we're always being pummeled around by conditions, but we can be free in the midst of that conditionality.
I have a quick question. So how do you see the process of deliberate practice of meditation and spiritual training? How do you explain that we are driven by condition at the start, but then as our practice goes on, does anything change in terms of driven by condition? Are we gaining more free will in terms of the end of that process, or is it all the same? It's just different factor.
It might look different, but yeah, no, I wouldn't say. In a way, maybe you could say we're believing less and less in free will. So it's more like maybe at the beginning of practice, it's kind of like the bell for service happens, and it's like I have to do it now. Like I have to do service now, and I have to chant and bow this way. And like they told me to do it that way, and I don't want to do it that way. And like maybe I made a mistake. And at the beginning, and then as time goes on, maybe it's more like the bell rings, and it's kind of like there's total freedom of like you could do the service or bow or not bow, but then you're just responding to the conditions of the bell. Like there's a Zen koan of Nemumon Khan of the whole world is so vast and wide. Why do you put on your Buddhist robe at the sound of the bell? That's the koan. And you could hear it as like there's total freedom here. So why do you do this narrow little thing of like chanting and bowing in this particular way? And I think it's a koan because you see that total freedom is right there and just responding to the next thing. So, like, now we can have lunch. Thanks for your attention and engaging in this strange